Today's topic is non-violent economy. Before we start on this subject, it is important to understand why it is important. Why are we even talking about it? So let us consider the current state of affairs. If you take any subject of study, right? It is only useful when you connect back that study to the amelioration of the human condition. In fact, any academic study that you have, we posit, starts off with the proposition, the purpose to ameliorate the human condition, to improve it in some way. Only then is it relevant. You can even consider a very abstract subject of study, such as quantum mechanics, right? The purported reason for why we are studying quantum mechanics is to understand the nature of reality. And yet, it has been connected back to some kind of quantum computing today, some way in which you can benefit humanity. So, however, the life of a human, if you look at life, it is whole, it is one. However, it is too complex for analytical study. When you apply inductive analytical methods, naturally what you end up doing is you decompose it into multiple aspects and you study them in isolation, right? So we have politics, political science, we have economy and economics, we have sciences, we have engineering, and so on and so forth. They're all aspects of one humanity, but decomposed and studied in isolation because of the inductive analytical methods used by modern study. Now, if you look at economics, right, and think about it in this reductionist environment, it has taken on very superior importance. It is a predominant aspect of our lives today. In fact, so much so, take a few examples. In 1918, there was a similar pandemic like the one we are going through right now, Spanish flu. Now, it also inflicted a lot of human suffering and misery, had similar death rates and things like that. But if you go back and look at the newspaper headlines from 1918, it is very interesting. They try to subjectively characterize the human misery of that condition. They say things like, the influenza is shaking the world, or 1 in 27 die of Spanish flu, things like that. Interestingly, if you look at, recently I was looking at a headline for COVID, it said something like, COVID is now impacting world economy to the tune of $8.8 trillion. Very recently also, the city that we're in, Bengaluru, went through a lot of flooding, extensive flooding. Headline on a newspaper reads, IT companies lost 225 crores because their employees were stuck in traffic for 5 hours. The fact is, the misery inflicted on these workers stuck in traffic for 5 hours, for anybody who's been through that, is unspeakable. And yet we measure that misery in terms of dollar figures and rupees. That's how important economics has become in our life these days. In fact, it occurs to the student that the economic aspect of a human condition has a parallel to the karmic principle of man, when you look at the seven principles of man. In fact, most of the fulfillment of karma or of desires on this plane in this day and age is achieved through money and economics. Just as that principle is the ruling principle now, we see in individual men at large, so also in the collective humanity, we see that economics has taken on an undue importance. Everything is subservient to it. Since the aim and purpose of theosophy is to work for the liberation and salvation of mankind, and man being the macrocosm of his universe, in achieving this end, we work for the amelioration, the liberation, and salvation of all sentient beings, since man is the macrocosm of his universe. So that being the aim, it is a very germane subject for us to look at the ruling aspect of the human condition of today, which is why we think this is a germane subject of discussion. Now, let us understand what we mean by economy, what we mean by economics in modern sense. Now, no topic on economics can be spoken of without the mention of Adam Smith, who is in many cases considered the father of economics these days. Now, this person wrote a very seminal work called The Wealth of Nations. And the fundamental proposition of that body of work is a very correct, I would say, and astute recognition of human nature, which is that every human being works for his self-interest. That Adam Smith astutely recognized. Then he said, okay, so that is a motor force that drives people. How can we use that and convert it to productive labor, which then can increase the wealth of nations? And can there be a system that can leverage this force, this almost unstoppable force? That was the system that Adam Smith came up with. That is largely the system that was followed up until the time of Milton Friedman. This is the second person that we have to talk about and his ideas to understand economics of today. Milton Friedman added on top of Adam Smith and added two more concepts. One is free market. Now, what is free market? Even Adam Smith recognized that there is supply and demand. There are producers and consumers. When producers produce too much of a certain goods, the value of that good decreases because there aren't as many consumers to consume it. When the value goes down, more consumers are incentivized to buy those goods, and hence it equilibrizes. The same happens the other way around. When there's too much consumption of a good, the price of it increases. The producers are incentivized to produce more. And we again achieve equilibrium. However, Adam Smith recognized that there is a limit to how far a price of a good can go, because there's only a certain affordability that one person can have. If the price of rice were to go to an extent where a normal person, an average person cannot afford it, we cannot say that that person is fit to die, that of starvation. Such a thing cannot happen. So Adam Smith recognized it. And also the other way around, that a producer cannot, having produced a good and spent some capital on it, lose all of it because the value of that good drops down too far below. So he said there has to be limits. But here comes Milton Friedman and claims that the free market economics is the right way to solve this problem, that there is the invisible hand of the market. If you unshackle it, unfetter it from any control, will naturally find balance. That is one of the very important aspects when you talk about economy today. Free market economics is at the center of it. The second point that he raised is called monetarism. The idea is that back in Adam Smith's time, money had value. You could take a pound and go to the Central Bank of England and exchange it for some equivalent amount of gold. There was gold standard. Milton Friedman made a radical claim that you don't need to anchor money to anything of value. It can be an entity of itself that basically is controlled by the central bank and the government, the supply of which is controlled by them. Now, this unleashes, in a way, the governments and the central banks to change people's lives by merely changing a small dial. Now, the way they control money supply is through interest rates. So if the central bank raises interest rates, people find return on investment. They'll invest their money with the central bank. So they're in a way sucking the money out of the system. And they reduce interest rates. It is profitable to borrow. And people don't want to invest money in the central bank. They take it out. There's money supply in the system. Inflation increases and so on and so forth. Now, Friedman recognized this fact that changing money supply has a profound impact on the economy. The exactly what impact, we are still discovering today. And some of it is not as salubrious as we thought it was. But these two aspects are very important when we talk about economy. Now, as you can imagine, the whole, you know, the increase and decreasing of money supply when it is disconnected from the gold standard is largely debt-based. What ends up happening is, let's say I have 100 rupees and I go deposit it in the bank. There is this system called fractional reserve system. Now, the bank will say, I have your 100 rupees. But in reality, they only are expected to hold 1 rupee and give away 99 as credit. Now, that 99 rupees goes out. There's a lot of commerce that happens around it. More money is generated, which comes back to the bank. Again, let's say 99 comes back. 1 rupee is held, 98 is given out, and so on and so forth. So you have this multiplication of money in debt because every bank is giving it out as credit. So the whole system is anchored and built on debt. And if everybody does what is called a bank run and goes to the bank and says, give me back my money, the bank does not have that money to give back. It is all given out as credit and the whole economy runs on debt. It's a very fragile system. Now, having understood the modern economy and how it functions, let's look at what its value system is. Like, okay, there is the mechanics of the economy. What values are you basing it on? Now, economists, like all modern scholars and secular subjects of study, do not make any divine. They want to keep everything secular. They don't want to have either divine decree or on the other hand. Anything to do with the king and monarchy and things like that, which used to exist before. So there is neither a divine sanction nor a monarchic decree. So you have to somehow base it on some values. So essentially, here are the values that it is based on. Now, if you look at it from a very human materialistic condition, you can posit two states. There is one state where if you enter that state, there is only bad outcomes that happen for everybody involved without any silver lining. It's a hypothetical state. Such a state doesn't exist. Almost every calamity has a silver lining. But if you posit that such a state exists where there are only bad outcomes for everybody, no silver lining, let's call that the dystopian state. Now you consider the opposite of that, which is there are only positive outcomes for everybody involved in that state. There are no side ill effects of any kind. No collateral damage. We'll call that the utopian state. The value system that economics is based on today says that if there are actions that are taken that move the current state that you're in incrementally towards the utopian state, you should be rewarded. And if you move it towards the dystopian state, you should be punished. Obviously, monetarily. So once you posit this value system, immediately you recognize that some people have skills that are more attuned to helping moving the current state towards the utopian state. Some people have better skills than others. So naturally, a hierarchy comes about. And you are rewarded based on your skills, and you move up, you're able to acquire more skills, and so on and so forth. There's a very deep hierarchy that is formed. And in fact, the system pulls that hierarchy in either direction. We see today that there is very large gulf in wealth distribution. In fact, in 2022, a report came out that globally, 10%, the top 10% of the population owns 75% of the global wealth. I mean, if you just think about it, if there are 10 people in a room with 10 meals in front of them, one person is essentially eating the meal of 7 to 8 people in that room. That is just mind-boggling. So given the value system that exists, the natural hierarchy forms out. And the natural outcome of that is this wealth disparity. Now, a disingenuous claim is made in popular literature that because this is such a fragile system that is built, that in a way, it is giving us uneasy peace in the world. That since World War II, we haven't had major wars such as World War I or II, or the wars that Europe has always been in, or the princely state always waged before that, because there is a sort of a mutual destruction. Everybody is sitting on debt-fueled economies that are very fragile. And so if you meddle and there is just an inkling of war, the whole thing could collapse. So it's almost like nuclear weapons. There's an assured mutual destruction. So the claim is made that this economic order is bringing about peace, world peace also. It's a very disingenuous claim. Let's actually look at it from a very sober and human perspective. Let's take even as from childhood. I'm pretty sure almost everybody on this call would remember an instance from their childhood when you're traveling on the road, somebody pointing out a destitute person and saying, if you don't study and make something of your life, you're going to end up like that. That is violence. That is violence. Right there starts a rat race. That you're told even as a child that unless you can compete and outshine others, that you will be destitute. There is no social security. As imagine as an adult, just in the city that we are in, people travel hours in noxious traffic to a workplace that essentially sucks all life energies out of them. They return home and have no energy for higher inclinations, higher purposes. Their life, as it were, is completely usurped by the workplace. That is violence wreaked by the workplace on its workers. Look at it from a community perspective. We are seeing, in fact, in this country, in front of our very eyes, one of the largest displacement of human population. The rate at which we are urbanizing is astounding. Communities in the villages are being entirely destroyed. There are cases where there are villages which are basically ghost villages. There is nobody living in there. There are houses that are dilapidated. We all possibly know of villages where the last generation is living there. All of their children have either left abroad or in some urban center with no plans of going ever back. So communities, which can only form in these rural centers, are being forcefully displaced because of development-based, so-called development-based incentives. So violence is being wreaked at the community level. When we look at it at the country level, governments have imposed high tax burden on people. And it's not the tax on the highest earning population, not on the corporations. Because those in power have corrupted in every democratic country the democratic institutions. So the taxation system is the heaviest on the working population. It is violence wreaked by the state at the country level on its own population. At the global level, this is very clear. We have seen instances where countries that are very well-to-do have used debt traps to undermine the sovereignty of those who have little. We have seen IMF and World Bank being used as instruments to again do very similar things, which result in what is now called neo-colonialism, where you, through the instrument of debt, you force these countries to open up their economies to be exploited by multinational corporations. It is again violence wreaked by stronger countries on weaker countries. So there is a lot of violence that is built into this economic order. And that recognition is very important. So what is the solution to this? We have seen in the past socialism and communism being offered as an alternative model. And if we take a look at this now, we've seen both of them in almost every case, without exception to the student's knowledge, degrade into dictatorship. And they've been failed states. Democracy also, if you look at it, the neoliberal thought in democracy posits that we can tax the rich and, you know, distribute to the poor, and essentially for the greater good, we can achieve a high taxation system. And this has not come to pass. This, in fact, was explored in America recently, where one of the richest people in the world, Warren Buffett, said that his tax bracket, his tax percentage that he pays, is lower than his maid who cleans his house. He literally said this. So there is, even in democracies with neoliberal thought, we have failed. It has not achieved the ends that we have sought, which is the use of this economic system for the greater good. It is very clear that there is no political solution to immorality. You can come up with any system, you can come up with any set of rules, as long as the people involved in such an enterprise are immoral, there is no solution. So, how can we achieve a nonviolent economy? What is an inspiration that we can look at? Well, when we talk about nonviolence, we can look no further than the father of our nation, Mahatma Gandhi, for inspiration. Now, for Gandhi, life was synthesis. It was a whole. It wasn't, as we see today, through inductive analysis, broken up into small pieces, into small aspects, and studied in isolation, and gone so far down the rabbit hole that those researchers don't even know why they started the research and cannot connect it back. For him, it was one whole. And so because it is one whole, there were very simple two principles that he was able to apply to every aspect of life. This was truth and nonviolence. So applying these two principles, Gandhi expounded a system of thought that a person by name J.C. Kumarappa, who was associated with Gandhi for most of his life, absorbed, and as an economist, came up with what he called the Gandhian economic thought. It is very interesting to look at this. It is very beautifully expressed in his book. And I'll try to summarize the key aspect here, and then we can analyze it further. So, in Gandhian economic thought, there is a proposition that there are five economic conditions that you could possibly think of. At the lowest level, the economic system that Kumarappa calls is called a predatory economy. Now, we'll make analogies to animals all through. If you look at a tiger doesn't add back value. It doesn't build anything. It lives in caves. It lives and takes what is in its environment, but it kills to survive. It has to take a life to survive. So in a way, a life has to be snuffed out for this animal to make progress and to live. Called it the predatory economy, the economy where you predate on something else or someone else or another country. A parallel to this is colonialism. When a country which is powerful like Britain colonizes another smaller, less powerful country, and colonizes it for the sole purpose of accessing all the resources and using it as a market. is a predatory economy. You add almost no value. The only value you add is to suck as much resources out of that country. It's a predatory economy. One level higher from that, we have what we can call the parasitic economy. A parasite, if you see, is not like a predator. It doesn't kill the host, but it slowly sucks the lifeblood out of that host to survive. Now, we can essentially think about neocolonialism that we have going on today as that. In neocolonialism, no country invades another country and takes it over and, you know, takes over its sovereignty or anything like that. Everybody has their sovereignty, but you suck the lifeblood out of the country through various artifacts, through various mechanizations. The analogy is, of course, any parasite. J.C. Kumarappa uses the analogy of a monkey in a forest doesn't build a nest, doesn't construct anything. It lives off of the forest. It eats fruits out of the forest. It is in a way a net negative, if you say. It doesn't kill anybody, but it is taking up resources and adding none back to the environment. One level higher than that, we can call it the enterprising economy. In an enterprising economy, you assert certain rights, but you also take certain duties and responsibilities. So you also give back. So there is a balance. Now, a bird, according to J.C. Kumarappa, you know, epitomizes this type of economy. A bird builds nests. It makes things that hasn't existed before, but it asserts its rights. When it is nesting, if another bird comes to its nest, it will shoo it away. It is asserting rights. But it also is creating something of value, because when the bird vacates the nest, other birds can use those nests. It's building something. Now, most people, most enterprises, most countries kind of operate in this, we call this the enterprising economy. Now, one level higher from enterprising economy is what J.C. Kumarappa calls the gregarious economy. And the analogy we can look at are bees. Now, if you look at a bee doesn't as much assert its right and individuality. It works for the colony. In fact, bees have been known to sacrifice themselves for the colony completely. They collect honey in excess of what they themselves need. And there is not only enough for the colony, but others around, like human beings use honey, bears eat honey. So it produces an excess and works for the collective good. Also assert some rights. The highest economy, this is the fifth and the highest economy that we can think of, is called the mother economy. Now, there is no parallel in the animal kingdom for this. And the only analogy we can use is the relationship of a mother to her child. A mother selflessly, self-effacingly, unconditionally sacrifices and works for her child. We see this in every mammalian species. There is no assertion of right. A mother doesn't assert her rights over a child, but unconditionally sacrifices and unconditionally serves the child. This is the what is called the mother economy. Now, there is no parallel in the animal kingdom except this mammalian mother-child relationship. There is no country that follows this model. And it was Gandhi's dream that India be the example of the mother economy. Now, the mother economy clearly is one that has no violence. And if you look at these five categories of economies, you see that violence, it reduces as you go up and is absent in the mother economy. It is very high in the predatory economy, absent in the mother economy. So how do you achieve that ideal of the mother economy is a question that we can ponder upon now. Now, for there to be this type of economy in a small community, every single unit of that community needs to act as a mother acts towards her child, right? Because an economy is only the collective, you'll say, the emergent behavior of individual units. It is the individual units that have to act in that manner. And when individual units act in that manner, what Gandhi calls Swarajya is truly possible. Swarajya is self-rule. Now, this word Swarajya has to be understood because it is the key that unlocks the mother economy. In fact, the preamble to the American Declaration of Independence has an echo to this Swarajya, although greatly misunderstood now. We are told that the masters, of course, have been with humanity since its childhood and have worked behind the scenes at many instances. And the Declaration of Independence is one such instance. So that document is of utmost importance. In the preamble to the Declaration, and I'm paraphrasing here, the founders of that country said that all men are created equal. And the creator, they call it the natural creator, nature creator. They didn't recognize a personal God. Has given inalienable rights to men. Among these are life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. In this, liberty is the condition of liberation. It is grossly misunderstood today. In fact, in modern America, I think, liberty doesn't mean Swarajya, which I think was the intention of the founding fathers. Today, it has devolved into Swechha, do as you please. In fact, it is almost do as your personality pleases, which is the very opposite of Swarajya, as we will see. So understanding this idea of Swarajya is very important and becomes the key to unlocking the mother economy. Now, there is only to the student a way to understand Swarajya, which is to shine the light of theosophy on it. Now, if you look at the word Swarajya, self-rule, it almost seems contradictory. For there to be rule, you need a ruler and that which is to be ruled. Now, if I look at myself, I feel I'm one. How can there be two? The explanation of this holds the key to understanding this term. Now, theosophy posits two very important concepts. One, the concept of the illusory lower self, we will call the personality. And that immortal, eternal, brooding aspect over this personality, that is changeless. Now, let's understand this from first principles. Let's take how we understand ourselves today. Our body-mind complex is how we understand and identify ourselves with. Now, this body-mind complex, if you look at it, is continuously changing from birth to death. In fact, every cell in your body that you have today, you didn't have 7 to 10 years ago. Your body completely replenishes all its cells in about 7 to 10 years. If you look at your own mental processes, you're possibly more wise from the life experiences that you've had. You have different outlooks in life. Your thought processes have changed. What we call even wisdom has possibly improved with age. Everything changes in this mind-body complex. So from an occult standpoint, and in fact from even a very logical standpoint, that which is constantly changing cannot be real, because it has to be projected on something that is real. That which is constantly changing also cannot cognize itself, because change cannot know change. And we'll take an analogy of you sitting in a train going on a track. There's another train on the parallel track that is going at the same speed in the same direction. Now you cannot tell sitting in the train whether the neighboring train is moving or not, because change cannot cognize change. there has to be something in us that is changeless, that is the witness of all these changes, for us to be able to recognize these changes. I mean, we're sitting here saying the body-mind complex has undergone lots of change, even subjectively as I look at myself. So there has to be the changeless. We'll call that the Kshetranya in Bhagavad Gita, which is the witness to the Kshetra, that is the body-mind complex that we've talked about. Now, that which is the witness is changeless. And that which is changeless, we have said, is real. That is the real self. It is a strange law, says HPB, that on this plane, the higher is in bondage to the lower personality. It is, I call, a very pathological Stockholm syndrome, if you will. So, Stockholm syndrome is where if somebody is held captive, those held captive start identifying themselves with the captors and start sympathizing with them. This is pathological, where the true self held bondage in this plane to the illusory self, the personality, yet we identify ourselves with the personality and do its bidding. Of course, the true, real, higher self, being not of this earth, cannot be held bondage in this world of illusion. It is an analogy, and that should not be stretched too far. But very clearly illustrates this point that on this plane, in every case, the lower personality has an upper hand. And we only have faculties that bring to our cognition material objects of this world, of the material world, of the physical world. And hence, of course, it is very obvious that we mistake ourselves to be this body-mind complex and this lower personality. What does Swarajya mean in this case? Now we have inverted. We are in a position where our true self is held bondage by the illusive self. Swarajya is, as HPB says, is where the lower personality becomes porous enough to the influence of the higher, the real self, that it is willingly able to take the bit and put it in its own mouth. As a horse that is well-trained accepts the bit in its mouth, it's only when the lower personality puts the bit in its own mouth willingly is there some semblance of Swarajya. Now, we have to also say, when you put a bit in your mouth, there is a reins that is attached to it. Who holds the reins in this case? It is your higher self. To be porous enough to the influence of the higher, that the higher has the ability to influence, the lower has the ability to be influenced by the higher. That is Swarajya. Because then the true self is ruling. Then we get rid of this dichotomy that we initially saw of how can there be a ruled and the ruler. The ruled is illusive. The real is the ruler. But in this world, there is that inversion. And to rectify that inversion is Swarajya. Now, we can extend this logic a little further. We said that the higher self is changeless. That which is changeless has no beginning and end, because beginning and ends are change. So that without a beginning or an end is eternal. That which is eternal is infinite. And that which is infinite is one, because there is one infinity. So to the degree to which there is Swarajya, the degree to which this self of all is in the ruling position, to that degree will men work and strive for others as they today work and strive for themselves. Because you identify more with unity rather than separation. So it is true Swarajya that unlocks the mother economy. How can you expect those that feel themselves to be separate from their fellow men to work and strive for others as if a mother works and strives for her child. It is only when you identify yourself with that unity, with the true self, with true Swarajya, can you unlock this mother economy. So in our preface so far, we have said that the mother economy creates Swarajya, but we have now seen that it is Swarajya that brings about a mother economy. The degree to which you're able to achieve Swarajya individually and collectively, to that degree is the mother economy unlocked in reality. To that degree, we will have a non-violent economy. There is one very important excerpt that we'll consider from The Key to Theosophy, and we'll end the talk. This is on page 229. To seek to achieve political reform before we have effected a reform in human nature is like putting new wine in old bottles. Make men feel and recognize in their innermost hearts what is their real true duty to all men, and every old abuse of power, every inequitous law in the national policy based on human, social or political selfishness will disappear of itself. Change cannot be affected from without. Change has to come from within. And it is the aim and purpose of theosophy to work on moral and causal planes to bring about true Swarajya, individually first and collectively. And it is only through the realization of true Swarajya will we unlock the mother economy and truly live to enjoy a non-violent economy. Thank you. We will end here, but open up the floor for any comments, questions, or discussions.